And now, the man who invented the 21st century, Mike Cannon.
So this third hour normally features an international flavor to it. This week in Palestine is a normal feature I bring to you about this time. However, this week we had a little problem with the feed of the show. So we'll be starting out this week with World Report out of Canada. Award-winning World Report often starts out the show with a lot of reporting about the United States, almost never covered on the lower 48 Main Street media. And because I feel many of us probably have more affinity with Canadians than we do with, let's say, Texas or Florida, I find it very healthy to bring you a Canadian perspective. Following this show, I'll be bringing you a very good and important interview lecture from New York bestseller Naomi Klein, who'll be talking about corporate disaster capitalism. It really is an eye-opening report. That will take us to the top of the hour of this week's show. As always, I'd like to thank you for taking some time out of your day to listen to this little ditty, this non-corporate-influenced alternative media radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. Thanks for listening.
You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
They were fascinated with my life and my career and who I am and the work I do with women. And, you know, their eyes were just lit up with curiosity and interest and, you know, wanting to make their own lives something, you know?
This is World Report for July 21st, 2008. World Report is an exploration of the anguish and the beauty of international events from a Canadian perspective. Three meetings loom large in this week's wave of events. The WTO negotiations in Geneva, meetings of the International Atomic Energy Agency and the Nuclear Suppliers Group, and the Pan-African Conference to End Impunity on Sexual and Gender-Based Violence. The latter is likely the most meaningful and therefore commands the most of our attention. I caught up with Neda Hyde just before she moved from Nelson to Victoria. She's been doing trauma work with women for 30 years and had just come back from a project in Africa. We'll hear the first part of that interview later in the show, but first, some of the context of the week. There never was much danger that anyone was taking the G8 all that seriously. The countries that had already failed to live up to their Kyoto commitments were posturing about climate change, promising aid that had already been promised before, sometimes more than once, and that was largely tied and therefore designed mainly to stimulate the economies of the donor nations, not the other way around. But leaders of the world's power economies are undeterred by simple folly. The World Trade Organization negotiations in Geneva this week faced significant hurdles due to the recent spike in food prices and the limited gains projected for developing countries, according to a statement issued by the Center for Economic and Policy Research this week. And that's just for openers. Most developing countries are net food importers. The recent increase in food prices has led some developing country governments to reconsider food security mechanisms such as tariffs, quotas, and domestic subsidies, which the WTO seeks to reduce. A number of countries have also imposed restrictions on exports in response to the food crisis. According to the co-director and economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, Mark Weisbrot, in its first 13 years in existence, the WTO has failed to deliver development results for the vast majority of low- and middle-income countries. He goes on to say that new factors such as rising food prices and the international financial crisis, which originated in the U.S. housing market, have made governments even more skeptical of international commercial agreements designed by the rich countries, end quote. At the same time, collapse of the U.S. government-chartered finance companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is resulting in a reluctance on the part of commercial banks to lend to one another. For example, Carlyle Capital, the mortgage debt investment fund of the famous Carlyle Group, is the most recent to ask that lenders halt further liquidation of collateral worth as much as $16 billion. Ambrose Evans Pritchard, International business editor of The Telegraph notes that foreign bondholders have begun to exercise a collective vote of no confidence in the devaluation policies of the U.S. government. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac underpin 60% of the $11 trillion market for U.S. home loans. Many who only months ago sought the privatization, deregulation, and liberalization of practically everything are now calling for emergency interventions by the Federal Reserve Bank and even the partial nationalization of the American banking system. Evans Pritchard believes that, quote, the twin crash in the dollar and U.S. agency debt reflects a broad exodus by global wealth managers afraid that America is spinning out of control, end quote. Tokyo's Nikkei index is crumbling. Asian, Mideast, and European investors stood aside at last week's auction of 10-year U.S. Treasury notes. It was a disaster, said Ray Attrill from ForecastWeb, and last week's Italian Treasury auction was also a flop. Evans Pritchard asks if this is the moment when America finally discovers the meaning of the Faustian pact it signed so blithely with Asian creditors. The U.S. has come to depend on $800 billion of inflows of cheap foreign capital each year to cover shopping bills, and the debtors are calling in the debt. As of June 2007, foreigners own just over $6 trillion in long-term U.S. debt, equal to 66% of the entire U.S. federal debt. The biggest holdings by country are Japan with $901 billion, China with $870 billion, the UK with $475 billion. Canada, which owns $106 billion, is 14th on that list. Meanwhile, the Chinese have quickened the pace of the appreciation of the yuan to choke off 8.7% inflation, and that is having the effect of slowing U.S. bond purchases. Meanwhile, India hasn't lost confidence in the U.S. This week, Indian negotiators will take the U.S.-India nuclear deal to both the IAEA and the nuclear suppliers group. In a view from Sri Lanka in the Daily Mirror, Amin Izzaddin asks if the Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh is bound to the burning bush. The answer seems to be yes. Izzaddin asks the right questions. Why is Washington going all out to help the nuclear program of a country which has not signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty? Compare U.S. policy toward India with its policy toward Iran, which has signed the Nonproliferation Treaty. The U.S. is threatening Iran with military action if Tehran doesn't abandon its uranium enrichment program. On the other hand, it rewards India, a country which possesses nuclear weapons, with U.S. technical and financial assistance. Why did the Bush administration say no when Pakistan made a request that a similar agreement be signed with Islamabad, too? Security and terrorism expert Bahu Kutumbi Rahman of the South Asia Analysis Group answers these questions. Muslim chat groups on the Internet have noted that not only the leftist parties, but even the Indian political class as a whole and the Indian elite have maintained a silence over the recent public execution of two Uyghurs, the arrest of about 80 others, and the forcible closure of 40 mosques by the Chinese. They have noted the energetic manner in which the Indian public opinion reacted to the repression of the Tibetans, but maintained a discreet silence on the repression of Muslims. As the date, July 22, 2008, for the vote of confidence from the Indian Parliament in the Manmohan Singh government nears, and as the possibility of an early election looms, a question often debated is the attitude of the Indian Muslims to the Indo-U.S. nuclear deal. Do they regard it as anti-Muslim because of the perceived anti-Muslim policies of the administration of President George Bush? That is the question which has been raised again and again by the critics of the deal and of Prime Minister Dr. Manmohan Singh. Indications are that the Singh government will take their request for special measures to permit the deal to both the IAEA and the Nuclear Suppliers Group this week. A Pan-African conference that aims to end impunity on sexual and gender-based violence begins today in Nairobi, Kenya. I'll have more about that conference, along with part two of my interview with Neda Hyde, next week. Neda Hyde is a psychologist with a background in nursing. She's been doing trauma work with women for the last 30 years. For the last 15 years, she worked in Nelson, mostly around issues of sexual abuse. During the winter of 2007, she was in Lesotho on a project sponsored by the Help Lesotho Foundation. I talked to her in our Nelson studios. You went to Lesotho as a clinical psychologist to do what?
I was invited by the Institute on Governance in Ottawa in conjunction with a Canadian charitable organization called Help Lesotho to go as a gender equity specialist to Lesotho. So I went last winter for 6 weeks to Lesotho and worked there doing work with principally with adolescent girls and women to help them to learn about their rights as women in a culture that's an extremely male-dominated and sexually violent culture. The gender-based violence against women there is breathtaking. It's way beyond what we experience in our culture.
I'm curious to explore just a little bit about. I mean, I hear you saying that you were invited. How did that come about? How did they know about you?
They knew about me because of a radio program, in which I wasn't on it. But I heard Sheila Rogers one morning as I was leaving the gym here, actually, and she was interviewing Dr. Peg Herbert. And Sister Alice, who were the two founders of this organization, Help Lesotho. And Peg Herbert was talking about this new organization and how Sister Alice had been a student of hers. Sister Alice is from Lesotho. She's a Roman Catholic nun who came to Ottawa to do graduate work. She was supported by her convent, the Sisters of Charity. And she was in Peg Herbert's graduate class at the University of Ottawa and was talking about and writing about in her master's thesis the terrible difficulties in Lesotho for children and young people to get education. There's no money. There are fees for high school. There are fees for uniforms, and every student has to wear a uniform. There are fees for books. And so most people there have trouble finding enough money to even eat once a day, let alone three times a day. So the fees were astronomical for most families. And what a terrible problem this was. So Peg Herbert got very involved and went over to Lesotho with Sister Alice and ended up starting this fantastic organization and now has been there. She still is in Ottawa, but there is an office in Lesotho and has done tremendous things for educational programs there. And one of the things that has happened that I got involved with was a child sponsorship program for $465 Canadian a year. Anyone can support a particular child to go to high school. And I thought that that was a fantastic thing to do. So my partner, Helga Jacobson, who is an anthropologist and taught at UBC for many, many years, is, of course, very keen on education, and as am I. And so we sponsored a girl to send her through high school. And then the next year, another girl, and the next year, another girl. So we have three girls now that we are putting through high school there.
And this is done through the Help Lesotho organization?
It's done through their organization. They have a tremendous website. You can just Google Help Lesotho, and it's spelled L-E-S-O-T-H-O.
Good.
Yes. And, you know, for lots of us as Canadians, $465 doesn't break the bank, and they've even got it divided down. You can pay $37.75 a month if that's more workable, and it makes the difference between life and death for girls in Lesotho. And that really is not being overly dramatic. It just is the way things are there.
Has anything changed with the fees? I know Kenya has had a different experience with fees, that the fees were imposed to some extent by their structural adjustment programs through the IMF and the World Bank, and they have eliminated the fees and brought hundreds of thousands of kids into school who simply couldn't afford to even think about going to school because of the fees.
Oh, well, at the present time in Lesotho, my understanding is that primary school is now available to students who can get themselves there, which in itself is a challenge because Lesotho is a very beautiful and high mountain country. So students have long distances to travel every day, you know, over the mountains to get to wherever the nearest primary school is. But still, there isn't much support yet available for high school. Some AIDS orphans, double orphans as they're called, which means that they've lost both parents to AIDS, are supported by the government. But, you know, it's a process to get the money and to get accepted. So there still are many, many students who are sitting at home and very upset, as, you know, we can imagine how that would be for our own students here who love school and who've done great in school. And after grade 7, there's nothing.
Right. And what is a common livelihood in Lesotho?
The country is... often it's farming and herding. So there are, and, you know, so the income is not great. There's not much industry there. And there's still very little infrastructure. So, you know, for instance, the town that the Help Lesotho office is in, has very few overhead lights at night even, or very few landline telephones. People who have telephones have cell phones. That's mostly what's available. And, you know, there are shopkeepers. There's, in that town, there's one hospital, so there are some nurses. Very few doctors. Most people who are doctors leave the country to seek employment someplace that where they can make more money or not be so overwhelmed by the numbers of patients to care for. So it's very difficult.
I'm torn between wanting to ask you more about the country and wanting to ask you about the project that you were on. Let's talk about the project that you, the work that you did there for a little while.
Yes. So I ran groups for adolescent girls.
These were girls past grade 7, presumably.
They were.
Right?
These were girls who were in high school, supported by Help Lesotho to go to high school. And they were living in a hostel that was run by the Anglican Church. Lesotho is a Christian country, and so a lot of the schools are either Anglican or Roman Catholic. Those are the main religious groups there.
What was the colonial country, the colonial power? Was that Britain?
There wasn't a colonial power there. It's quite different than lots of African countries. And I might just say it's a very small country. It only has 2 million people, or maybe just a little bit over 2 million. And it's entirely surrounded by South Africa.
Uh-huh. It's an enclave.
Yes, it really is. So, and as I said before, it's very, very beautiful. But one of the problems there now is that it's got a huge drought that's been going on for the last 5 or 6 years. And I keep hearing from people there who I email that, you know, it's spring and they still haven't had any rain. So that, of course, means that people, I know I'll get back to the question about the project,
right.
But just to fill in just a little bit about the country, people grow their own gardens. That's a lot of what people who have very low incomes can do to feed themselves. And, of course, in times of drought, you know, they don't have the money the resources, nothing to get irrigation systems, nothing fancy like that. So if there isn't rain, there isn't food. And so there's been big problems there because of that. But to get back to the project, one of the things that I did in this group was because the country has been very slow to, as so many other places, to really recognize women as equal members of the culture and the society. In fact, I think it was only in 2003 that women were legally given equal rights under the law. And of course, common practice is very slow to follow on what is legal.
Is it unusual for girls to get to the level of high school?
It is unusual for girls. So that's one of the reasons that Help Lesotho has focused on providing tuition for girls to go to high school to try to right some of these wrongs that have happened over the years. And so I met with the girls and I talked to them about the legitimacy of equality and what equality looks like. You know, the necessity to be able to stand up and speak out for one's own rights. And then because there's so much sexual violence, to talk to girls about how to say no to sexual advances that are unwanted from boys, including rape, which is very common there. And the girls have grown up in families, of course, where they've seen their fathers batter their mothers. In the 6 weeks that I was there, I heard of two women who'd been killed by their husbands just in that small period of time. And these were women who were relatives of people I worked with. So that was a very, very just small group of what is going on there.
Are these traditional behaviors, or are they behaviors that are associated with some kind of urbanization or some other kind of alienation?
They're behaviors, that's a good question. Over the years, and less so now, but up until, I would say, 10 or 15 years ago, a lot of the men in Lesotho found work in the South African mines. So they left the family to get employment, mm-hmm. and often were away for a year, 2 years at a time. So that makes for a very disenfranchised family group. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, they would come home from time to time and bring some money to their family. But, you know, often they were seeing prostitutes or other women while they were away, and often they would come home, and whether or not the wife had had any other relationship while they were gone, there often was that accusation. Mm-hmm. And they also brought HIV/AIDS home with them. And so the rate of infection in Lesotho, it's very high. It's the third highest rate of infection in the world there. So it's a tremendous problem. One quarter of all people in Lesotho is HIV positive, and that's a staggering statistic.
That is huge.
Yeah. So it was very important to talk to the girls about sexual matters, because they said that their parents, and often it was the mother, if they even had parents still, if the parents hadn't already died, but in families there, sexual matters are not talked about openly. So they had no way really to get information. And as big a problem as HIV/AIDS is, it's a shameful secret. Nobody talks about it. It's unreal, you know, to be in a place where it's going on all the time. People are getting sick all the time. Saturday is funeral day. There are cars honking on the main street as the funerals go by all day long, the processions of funerals. And nobody says, so-and-so died of AIDS. They always say, oh, he was sick, he died. And that's all that gets said.
So it's something more than just a fear of stigmatization, if that's the case. I mean, if the person is dead, then there's nothing much more that you can do to them.
No,
I suppose.
Except that people don't want anybody else to know what their father or mother died of, because, of course, it gets so intimately linked with sex. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there are babies born that are HIV positive if the mother is HIV positive and hasn't been able to either get tested and know that, or if she knows it, even to ask for treatment is still, it is very stigmatizing.
Mm. So what happens if somebody, if it's found out that someone is HIV positive?
Well, they're often shunned. And there, of course, are some very brave souls who are trying to change that. I saw one young man there who had a bright red T-shirt on that had written in, I think it was white letters across it, HIV positive. And I thought, how courageous of him. And I saw a few other people who came from some Christian organization in which they were wearing HIV positive T-shirts, and on the back they had some kind of saying from their church that was really supporting the necessity of people speaking out, getting tested, and knowing their status. So I talked to the girls in the groups about all of these things. And of course, everybody hears about, it's a small world there, you know, so they all hear about things that are happening around them. But unless there's somebody who really almost gives them permission to speak and encourages them to speak, it's still hidden within that cloak of secrecy and shame. So that was a big part of what I did. Not to mention role modeling, what it's like to be a woman in the world. You know, I came halfway around the world from this other country, Canada, mm-hmm. you know, to spend time with them, and I really cared about them, and I think that was fantastic role modeling for them, because they were fascinated with my life and my career and who I am and the work I do with women. And, you know, their eyes were just lit up with curiosity and interest and, you know, wanting to be, make their own lives something, you know. And that was tremendous for me to be able to be a part of.
That's it for World Report today. This morning's show will be rebroadcast this evening at 6. The World Report website and blog is at worldreport.cjly.net. You can listen to a copy of this broadcast, or subscribe to a podcast, or listen to just one show at that same website, where several options are on offer. Of course, our preference is that you get your podcast from the KCR site. A more complete archive is available at the Radio for All site, and if you have client-side software on your machine, podcasts of this show are also available from iTunes. You can leave a comment about any of the stories on the website, or send email directly to earthling@cjly.net. Send surface mail to Box 767, Nelson, Canada, V1L, 5R4, Attention World Report. Thanks to the band Married to Music for the theme music played at the top of the show. That's from their vinyl album, Miracles. Thanks to Sidewinders Coffee Company for their continued sponsorship of the World Report Question of the Week. And thanks to Mike Cannon in Wausau, Wisconsin, Guy LaPointe of the Crow Healing Network, and Laura Savinkoff at the Boundary Peace Initiative. I'm Jim Terrell at World Report for Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, British Columbia. Thanks for listening.
Wake up.
Sunday mornings, the irreverent Uncle Pete. With your Sunday morning soft start, 8 to 10 a.m.
You must wake up.
Uncle Pete will bring you a kinder, gentler radio wake-up call.
Come on. Wake up.
That's Sunday mornings, 8 to 10 a.m.
Wake up, love.
That soft starts Sunday mornings, 8 to 10 a.m. Only on 93.3 WNRB LP, Wausau.
Can you not see that little light up there? Where? There.
relax, just go with it.
Naomi Klein, activist, journalist, and author of The Shock Doctrine, spoke in Vancouver last week. She was on stage with a panel of activists struggling for immigrant rights, justice for First Nations, and an end to poverty. We'll bring you some of those voices on a future program, but here now is Naomi Klein speaking on the connections between struggles in the face of disaster capitalism, an economic system where the interests of life, liberty, and justice are at fundamental odds with the interests of the market.
More and more of the global economy now does better the worse things get. Now, we know about the military-industrial complex. We know that weapons companies make money when there's war. But we are entering a new phase here, and we're seeing it in many ways. We're seeing it right now with the food crisis, where companies like Monsanto and Cargill are reporting staggering record profits in the midst of the crisis. We see it in the AIDS pandemic with the pharmaceutical companies making money hand over fist. We see it with the explosion of the Homeland Security complex, which is a now $200 billion global industry, more than Hollywood and the music industry combined. So it isn't just weapons. And these are the companies, you know, how do we define a company that fits within this, what I'm calling disaster capitalism complex? These are the companies that do better the worst things get, i.e. they don't have the same interests as us. You know, a terrorist attack happens, the NASDAQ goes up now, goes up. Why? Because all the Homeland Security stocks are soaring. There's a natural disaster, the stock market goes up now. Why? Because the insurance company stocks go up, because the mercenary company stocks go up, because the market is adapting. It is adapting to a new reality of constant crisis, of constant crisis. So this sort of 1990s idea of no two countries with McDonald's have ever gone to war, trade creates stability, no. This is an adaptation to what we might think of as the Israeli model or the Colombia model. Our markets, actually some of the most successful economies in the world, the Israeli economy is second only to China and India in terms of its rates of economic growth. Colombia has the highest growth rates, I believe, besides Chile and Latin America. And what Colombia shows is that you can have low-level warfare, you can get the resources out of the ground, and you can secure it with private mercenary companies, and you can make money on both ends. And actually, that's a more profitable model than the kinds of economic alternatives that are being developed in Bolivia and Ecuador, which is precisely why there's been this push to pull Bolivia and Ecuador into the so-called war on terror model with these incursions into Ecuadorian territory by the Colombian government. I actually was recently in Ecuador presenting the book and doing some research there, and I'm going to talk more about it. I was in Bolivia as well, and I was touring with a fantastic Colombian activist named Hector Mondragon, who works with the Cauca people. Some of you may know his writing. It's published a lot on CNET. He's an economist who specializes in agrarian reform, and he's also a torture survivor, and he's one of the people who really influenced the writing of the Shock Doctrine. And we spoke on many platforms together where I would, you know, sort of give the big picture thesis of the book. And then Hector would say, this is how it is being applied in a state of constant shock in Colombia. And Colombia is your future, he was saying to Bolivians, if this model is able to be imposed on your countries. I was in Calgary in September, and I mentioned this at the event I did in Vancouver, and some of you may have heard this story before, but I went to Calgary to do a talk about the Shock Doctrine, and there was all this hype before I went in the Calgary Herald. Like, there was the lead article was, Naomi Klein's a brave woman for coming to Calgary. and it was this whole thing of, like, how dare you come to the sovereign state of Alberta, you know? But the weird thing was, when I got there, the book was a bestseller. It was number one on the Calgary Herald list, which I think they tried to scratch out. But and the event that I did was sold out, a 900 seat venue. And you know, there aren't 900 lefties in Calgary, right? So who are these people? And so I was joking, you know, that they thought it was a how-to guide, right? And that's why they were there. They were buying the book for tips, right? How to get in early on Iran or something, right? But you know, actually, that is not the case. And you know, Albertans are getting sick and tired of their leadership clash of disaster capitalists. But what was so interesting was the awareness in Alberta about how intimately connected their economic boom, the economic boom that they're experiencing because of the tar sands, how connected that is to global warfare and instability. Because, of course, the tar sands, the vast majority of the oil that is now being extracted from the tar, wasn't counted as part of the global oil reserves before Iraq was invaded. And that's because it cost more to turn the tar into liquid than you could sell it for. It cost $25 a barrel. So it was only after the invasion of Iraq, when the price of oil climbed past 30 and then now past 130, I believe we're at, that it became economically feasible. So what happened was, you know, we say Iraq was invaded for its oil. Well, they actually haven't gotten Iraq's oil yet, although they're getting really close. But there has been an oil boom because of the invasion of Iraq, because of the threat of attack on Iran, because of the state of constant instability that sends the price of oil soaring. But the boom's in Canada. We've gotten the oil boom. So when I was addressing this audience in Calgary, I said, what is the one thing that could threaten your economic boom? And they said, peace. Because it actually changes your brain when you're living truly within the disaster capitalist economy. You can't help it, no matter who you are. You understand that the worse things get, the better things are for you. And that doesn't mean you're a bad person. It just means you actually are living in the real world. So you read the newspaper differently. You can't help it. So we are deeply embedded in this economy of disaster. The fact that Canada's economy isn't in worse shape is intimately linked to that. The fact that parts of the economy are getting worse and worse because of the strength of the dollar are linked to that. Now, it's also a challenge to a lot of what we're told about conventional wisdom about climate change, which is that if the price of oil gets high enough, the market will respond and we'll have these huge infrastructure investments in sustainable energy sources like wind and solar. Well, that hasn't happened. But as far as I was saying, there's a massive infrastructure investment going on in Alberta, massive technological investments going on to try to figure out how to more efficiently transform that tar and later the shale into liquid form. So actually, it's the opposite of what we've been told, that the high prices are creating the economic incentive to do the dirtiest form of extraction possible, and we're not investing in the other sources of energy that we might invest in. So We spent some time today, earlier today. This is we had a smaller session that was convened by Arthur Manuel about the wave of criminalization of First Nations people across Canada. And so this is the second time that Samuel and I have shared a platform. And this is also connected, the fact that we're seeing more and more standoffs, more and more arrests of First Nations leaders who are standing up to resource extraction, standing up to gentrification across the country. I think sometimes it's hard to tell whether this is just status quo or something more is happening. Something more is happening. And something more is happening for the same reason that the tar sands are exploding. Commodity prices across the board are through the roof, okay? So what that means is that, you know, we had the sort of first colonial pillage. And what was left were the most remote areas, the hardest to reach areas, the most expensive to reach areas, the most expensive to develop resources, the parts of the world where you have some of the greatest fighters among indigenous communities who you know are going to put up a hell of a lot of resistance. Well, those parts of the world were sort of put on hold, like we'll get to you later. Okay, later is now. Later is now, because the price of all of these commodities is so high. It's oil, it's gas, it's coal, it's gold, it's everything. This is a final colonial pillage that is going on around the world, where we're seeing these resource companies with Canadian mining companies at the forefront just going in regardless and bringing mercenary companies with them to deal with the resistance. It's happening around the world. And so the fact that this event happened earlier today to discuss this criminalization process is intimately linked to the disaster capitalism economy and all of these companies that do better the worse things get. Sam said earlier today that they had thought that they were safe because they're so remote, 600 kilometers north of Thunder Bay, right? That he grew up thinking we're too far away for them to bother with us. No one is too far away for them to bother when you have the price so high. So we have to understand what we're dealing with here. In British Columbia, you have another factor, a layering on top of this, which is the Olympics. So you have the resource hunger of the commodity boom, and on top of that, you have the land hunger of the Olympics, linked to skiing, linked to gentrification. And so that is the context. I want to pick up a little bit on what Khalid was talking about fear and profiled communities. It reminded me of a conversation I had early on when I was researching this book with a man named Federico Alodi, who's the founder of the Center for the Victims of Torture in Toronto. It's the first such center. Now there are many around the world. We were talking about Guantanamo, and he said to me, well, you know, torture is always public. And he just sort of said it casually, as if it was something that everybody understood. But I had never really thought about it before, because I always thought of it as something that states try to hide, right? That an investigative journalist intrepidly uncover the fact that torture is happening. But the truth is that torture, in order for it to be effective, always needs to be semi-public. We always need to sort of know about it. And we understand that if we think about other countries, right? If we understand it, if we think about Latin American countries that disappeared their citizens, and they did it in this quasi-public way, because of course it was a warning. It was not just a targeting of the individual who was being thrown into a car and sped off to a torture center. It was a warning to the whole community who saw it. They said, this is what's happened. The message was, as a form of communication, this is what happens to you if you step out of line. And I think we are in denial, so many of us, about the fact that we are being communicated with. We're being communicated with in the threat of deportations, in the threat of becoming a terrorist suspect or a sleeper cell. Some communities understand this very, very well. But I think all of us need to understand that these tactics, which are understood everywhere else in the world as tactics of state terror, not mere human rights abuses, are being practiced on the most marginal communities in Canada by our government. Now, I want to talk a little bit about this shift that the Israeli state went through when they realized that they didn't need peace to have prosperity. They needed security. This was a dramatic change in discussion, in language, and I think it's interesting because of the language being used around the security and prosperity partnership. It isn't about peace. It isn't about justice. It's about security and prosperity. And the Israeli business community in the early 1990s actually started lobbying for some sort of a peace accord with the Palestinians, which is ultimately what led to the deeply, deeply flawed Oslo Accords. But actually, that happened because the Israeli business community saw globalization happening. This is the early 90s, you know, post-89. And felt themselves isolated from this economic boom. And there was this slogan of prosperity through peace that took hold. Or a business peace was another phrase that was used. Now, what the Israeli business community talks about is prosperity through security. Peace is not necessary. What's needed is the ability to secure the perimeter. But more than that, the Israeli economy has adapted to this reality of constant warfare and found ways to profit from it. And one of the ways that the Israeli state profits from it has been by privatizing much of the response to the occupation, much of the occupation itself, the infrastructure, and then turning Israel into a kind of a showroom for a effective sort of green zone country, a country that can exist with war all around but provide security for its citizens. And, you know, this is one of the sort of more controversial parts of the book, is looking at how Israel has marketed itself to countries like Canada, the U.S., European countries, running all kinds of extensive tours for our police, borders, politicians to come to Israel and see how you can have prosperity without peace, but with security. And the selling of all this expertise in border control, checkpoints, CCTV cameras, and so on. One of the things that I'm trying to challenge these days is some of the discourse around, you know, the war in Iraq being a failure, the war in Iraq being a disaster. You know, obviously it's a disaster for Iraqis. More than a million Iraqis have died. It's a disaster for U.S. taxpayers. It's a disaster for U.S. soldiers. But it is not a disaster for everyone. The occupation of Iraq has really turned that country into a laboratory for privatized warfare and occupation. And what we see is that the longer the occupation wears on, the more privatized it becomes, and the more it becomes this laboratory for all of these private security companies to take on functions that they never have had before or not for many years, like prisoner interrogation or the complete running of the green zone in the case of Halliburton, which is really sort of like a city-state for Halliburton. What the stage we're at now is that all these companies that got a taste of a kind of a corporate rule in Iraq, and right now in Iraq there are 180,000 private contractors and only 160,000 foreign soldiers. So there are more private contractors than there are soldiers. And this has a knock-on effect, because in all of the other war zones, like Afghanistan, Colombia, the line is, well, we don't have enough soldiers, so we need to fill it in with mercenaries. And Blackwater has been going around saying, let us into Darfur. They want to, you know, they're saying the UN can't do it, we'll do it. So all these companies that got a taste of this in Iraq are now looking to diversify. They're not sure how long this is going to last, but they're looking to diversify. And I think it's really important for us to look at where they see their growth industries, okay? Blackwater is a particularly interesting company to look at because it's so telling. I mean, they see three growth areas. And it's always important to remember that Eric Prince, the CEO of Blackwater, said that he wanted to do for the U.S. military what FedEx did for the post office, okay? He sees himself as fully within the neoliberal paradigm, but taking it to its final frontier, okay? And he sees three areas: genocide prevention, okay, in Darfur, disaster response to natural disasters, i.e. responding to the increasing numbers of disasters as a result of global warming, and border control. Okay, they have just opened a new base 3 miles from the border with Mexico. There was a huge fight about it because the community that they were supposed to open up in, called Potrero near San Diego, kicked them out. They found another community and they've opened up because they have said that they see the border as a major new industry. Halliburton got a major contract to build prisons for in the case of a sudden influx of refugees. Okay, now this is all connected because, of course, we have an economic model that constantly produces disasters and crises, which constantly produce mass migration, whether it's NAFTA, whether it's a natural disaster, whether it's a war. So there's now the ability to profit from those disasters and also to profit from containing the people who move in the cases of those disasters, and also to profit from saving the wealthy, saving the elites, from the living with the effects of these disasters. So there's, for instance, some of you have heard me talk about this before, a private company that was launched a year after Hurricane Katrina in Florida called HelpJet. And HelpJet is a charter airline whose slogan is that we'll turn your hurricane into a luxury vacation. And they work on the country club model, where you pay an annual fee, and if a hurricane is coming to your part of coastal Florida, they will let you know, and they will arrange for you to get out of the hurricane zone, take you to the private airport terminal, whisk you off to the resort of your choice, to the five-star resort of your choice. Now, we are literally getting into this kind of a phase, and during the wildfires in California last summer, we saw something that we hadn't seen in more than 100 years, which is private firefighters showed up in the wealthiest areas working for the insurance giant AIG. If you lived in the wealthiest areas that were hit by the forest fires, you paid extra on your insurance premium, and as part of being a VIP member, your home was sprayed down with this white foam sort of fire retardant, and your home was protected and your neighbor's was not. Now, everyone was shocked by this. In the 8 months since then, 5 of AIG's competitors have announced that they too, and wildfire season is coming, and this year there will be 5 more insurance companies offering VIP private firefighting protection. Okay? So this is the way the market is responding to global warming. Do we get it? Okay? Not with solar and wind, not with moving to green energy and sustainable living, but actually by reenacting the rapture on Earth, okay? And it is a huge industry, and we have to understand that we are not all in this together, okay? This is something that was also said this morning, that we were talking about the similarities with the biblical myths of escape. You know, the boat's coming, you and your friends can get on, everyone else can drown. You know, there's a big elevator in the sky coming to take you and your friends. And one of the speakers earlier today said, you know, only the rich can afford to press eject. And so I think there's a lot of naivete sometimes in our environmental discourse where it's sort of like, you know, at least even Dick Cheney has grandkids, you know, we just have to hold hands, we're all in it together, raise awareness. You know, Dick Cheney's going to Dubai. We need to understand this. With his grandkids. And the other area that, so we see the growth areas, responding to global warming. By the way, Monsanto has been buying up hundreds of patents on what they call climate-ready seeds, seeds that are resistant to the effects of global warming, salination, drought. And this VIP, disaster rescue, and containing and surveilling the disposed of people, the displaced people, the migrating people. All of this is the new face of neoliberalism. With the Olympics coming, we have to understand that the Olympics increasingly are the state of emergency, state of exception, that creates the leap forward for the imposition of this privatized security state. I just came back from China, or I was in China in March, for several weeks researching a big piece about how the Pearl River Delta is now this laboratory that's the new frontier for the homeland security industry. Now, in China, they're projecting a $33 billion industry in CCTV cameras, facial recognition software, biometric IDs. It's all the big players, Honeywell, IBM, GE, the company that takes your picture at the U.S. border and fingerprints. It's called L1. They're in there, too. All of these American companies are rushing in, and the Olympics is what has unleashed all of this, because after the Tiananmen Square massacre, it actually was illegal for American companies and Canadian companies, too, to sell equipment that could be used for repressive purposes in China by the Chinese police. But now it's going in the name of Olympic security. And there's a security arms race going on around the Olympics. And just to put this in perspective, after September 11th, the first country to have the Games, very shortly after September 11th, was Greece, the Athens Games. And they spent an unprecedented amount on security because there was such a heightened awareness and fear at that point. They spent $1.5 billion on security, okay? China is spending $13.4 on Olympic security. All of the equipment is staying, okay? By the time it's 2010, the standard will now be Beijing, okay? And this is what we have to prepare for. So, is there another way of responding to our crises beyond containing the poor and saving the rich? As I mentioned, I was recently in Ecuador, and of course, part of this model of profiting off of climate change is the Kyoto model. It's carbon trading, carbon credits, marketizing pollution. Well, in Ecuador, they're developing another model. And just to put this in a little bit of context, well, as you know, Ecuador is one of the governments, one of the countries in Latin America that has recently elected a left-wing government led by Rafael Correa. Interesting guy, lefty economist. I like him because one of the first things he said when he came to power, he was asked, well, what can we expect from your economic policies? And he said, let's put it this way, I'm no fan of Milton Friedman's. And then he announced that he planned to close the military base in Manta, Ecuador, which is the largest military base, U.S. military base in Latin America. And he said the only way that he would keep it open past its lease expiry date in 2009 was if Ecuador was allowed to open a military base in Miami. So it's closing. You know, he comes from a classic, what in Latin America is called a developmentalist economic tradition. And before he became president, he was a finance minister for a time. and was at war with the World Bank because there is a pipeline that's going through the Amazon. And Rafael Correa, and it's being funded largely by the World Bank, Rafael Correa wanted there to be a clause in the agreement that 20% of the profits from the pipeline would go to healthcare and education, okay? And he was told, no way. And that's why he's also been at war with the World Bank since he's come to power, and they kicked out the official, and he accused them of extortion and so on. So, you know, on the surface, that's a really progressive position. And the problem that Rafael Correa faces is that indigenous people in Ecuador don't want the pipeline at all. They want the oil to stay in the ground. And there's a huge leave it in the ground movement in Ecuador because this is going through the Yasuni National Park, which is a part of the Amazon that has more species in 1 hectare than in all of North America, incredibly biologically rich. And the pipeline represents the end of ways of life for indigenous people in that area. And Ecuador has the largest and strongest indigenous federation in, I believe, the world. It's called CONAI. And they have come into very strong conflict with Correa for their leave it in the ground position. And they've come up with a compromise. And the compromise is called ecological debt. And what ecological debt means is that we should pay Ecuador to leave it in the ground. Because why should Ecuador pay the costs for global warming? Why should they not develop the resources that they have when they have been through more than 500 years of exploitative extraction and have not contributed in any major way to the emissions that have led to global warming? And so they've come up with this model and have proposed it on the international stage. So far, they haven't gotten much traction. But their deadline, and I think we should be thinking about this, is in a year and a half, there's a meeting in Copenhagen to come up with the post-Kyoto consensus. And I think the real danger is that the post-Kyoto consensus will be all more of this market-based solutions to global warming. What we can do by talking about ecological debt is really shift the discussion. It questions who is a creditor and who is a debtor. It flips it on its head. It says Ecuador doesn't owe us, we owe Ecuador. And it also raises the question of, you know, what does it mean, who should pay and how should we pay? And then we might be starting to talk about some of the outrageous profits being made by the oil giants. Every single quarter, it's a new record. I believe Shell's last quarter was $8 billion in clear profits. And then we could think about what this paradigm might look like in Alberta. And we also might think about what our ecological debt is to First Nations people in this country. Because, of course, we owe an enormous ecological debt. What's interesting about thinking about ecological debt in Canada, and in BC in particular, is that there is such a powerful legal basis for arguing these points. I want to quote actually something that Arthur Manuel today was talking about his father, George Manuel, who is one of the greatest First Nations leaders Canada has ever had. And Arthur, if you'll forgive me, I think what you said your father said was, we never signed nothing, that's how come you can do what we do. The point is, of course, that much of British Columbia is unceded First Nations land. And that represents a tremendous, hard-won victory. It's not just that they didn't get around to it.
Okay, I had to cut off about 4 minutes of Naomi Klein's interview there. Sorry about that. But we are coming up to the end of the show. I'd highly recommend Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine. The Mike Cannon Show is produced for community, not-for-profit, and or micropower radio use worldwide at the Glee Glee Studios. Special thanks this week to my executive producer, David Preckel, who is making sure that the show starts on time. And thanks to web and technical assistance from Michael Redfox. Comments or suggestions are always appreciated. Email me at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com or slow mail me at P.O. Box 244, Mosinee, Wisconsin, 54455. That's P.O. Box 244, Mosinee, Wisconsin, 54455. Next week's show will be under a little bit of time management concern since I'll be traveling and the format will be slightly askewed, but it'll still be good though. So until next week, as always, I am yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
This has been Glee Glee Productions, specially made for WNRB Central Wisconsin Community Radio. I'm Mike Cannon.
Sleep now. It'll hurt less in the morning.